surface, but I want to take as much time as we can dealing with the issues that you have perhaps coming from your papers that you're working on or other questions about the course. And so I want to open up a lot of time for you as sort of a review and time for asking deep questions that are coming up in the research in your papers. By the way, did I return? I think I returned everybody's outline. That's not one today. Okay, that was in an email. But okay.
We had a great Gemstone discussion this morning.
Excellent. Excellent. Anything you want to share with the whole group?
I don't know if I can condense it down into something.
Okay. Somebody else wanted to. And what are the questions that I might be able to help with, or points of interpretation that I might be able to?
Yeah, there's this one, and maybe you can articulate this better, but we were talking about the whole thing about the hunting the antelope and the magical.
Right.
And apparently that's taken from a particular guy in 1905, and that, Joseph Campbell wrote about it as well.
That's
and,
right.
And apparently Gebser got
just quoted.
Yeah.
According to, I've heard this.
Yeah, but the thing is that the thing about Campbell and Gebser, now I know almost nothing about Campbell, but you were talking about how Campbell had more of a unitary kind of model of consciousness, where Gebser made distinctions and made that primary in a sense. Could you articulate that a little more clearly?
Well, Joseph Campbell is not a philosopher, so he doesn't have a clearly articulated philosophy from what I can tell. But in his Hero with a Thousand Faces, he talks about monomyth, and he uses the hero's journey to show throughout cultures and time that myths are very similar, have very similar structures and ideas. And so he believes in the unity of consciousness, whereas, you know, Gebser obviously is more structural. And so I was just pointing out that they both use that exact same antelope story, whereas Joseph Campbell actually has it quoted from what Frobenius had written. And then Gebser kind of takes from that.
Right.
But that, I mean, like I said, Joseph Campbell doesn't have a clearly articulated philosophy on the unity of consciousness. It's more something that you can see through his works.
Right. Yeah, there'd be interesting questions there about what time periods he's mainly dealing with and so forth. But I think that I think the issue underlying some of this, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, I may be missing it, but I think the issue also that Laura's been bringing up is the question of the plasticity of human experience. Was how plastic, how variable is human experience? So we assume in modern times that the quality of our experience is largely determined by our genetics, and that we know that the genetics have not changed that much during the period of time that Gebser and Campbell are discussing. And so an argument could be made that people were always pretty much like they are now, and that Gebser is fantasizing and getting a little bit carried away by suggesting such very different structurings of consciousness. Is that part of the issue?
Yes, that's definitely something that I've been working with. That's not my conclusion, but...
Okay, well, I was just raising a question. Not
yeah,
a question.
Yeah, that's a question that I'm...
Yeah, and so the way I think of it, and this comes particularly from Sri Aurobindo, but it's a more interesting idea, I think, that the significance of the human genetic accomplishment is not that it determines us into the kind of experience that we are now having, but that rather it establishes in us the basis for a large variety of possible experiences. Right? So it's sort of like, well, once you evolve a TV screen, you can show any image on it. And in the same way, once you evolve a human consciousness, you may be able to display the world through that human consciousness in a very great variety of ways. So that's one thing I want to say. I want to claim that human experience is immensely plastic. much more so than we realize. And really the fact that we all, most of us have had some experience with psychedelics should give us some obvious proof of the great variety of different sorts of ways of experiencing the world are inherent in the human instrument. Secondly, there's a very strong and extremely pernicious tendency to assume that now we know about the nature of the physical world, and that the nature of the physical world was always the way we think it is now, and that if we, that if a physicist were to go back into those days, they would find the same things. And so obviously, if anybody back then thought the world was different, it was just because they were ignorant and superstitious and hadn't figured things out yet, right? But what I've been trying to teach in this class is that the way we think the world is now is not the way the world actually is. It's just the way the world looks through a particular structure of consciousness. And that the world itself operates according to principles so different from the ones that we attribute to it in science, that these earlier mutations of human experience could have tuned us into aspects of reality of which we have now lost sight. So if that's helpful, that's a comment on this issue.
Pursuant to that, one of the things that we were trying to figure out was, does Gebser say that mental latency, was it available to like people in the magical time?
Yes.
To what extent, if it's there and it's latent, was it used in the way that we think about mentality now to any measure?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean. That is, people weren't doing logical dialectics at that point.
Well, part of our discussion was, if the full capacity of everything is available at all times, it's just latent, then our full mental capacity was available in magic times just latent, because it had not been explicated.
Yeah, you see, it's probably a question of what latent means. And these are very good questions that I've been thinking about for a long time. And the way I'm now thinking about it is that we've been talking in this class about the transphysical worlds. And so we have the mental world and the astral world and the physical world. Now we also have these mutations of consciousness in Gebser's part, which is the magical and the mythical and the mental. These are the words that we pick up from the tradition. There's a problem here, however, because it seems to me, as I've thought about this more and more, that in the magical mutation of consciousness, human awareness was polarized at the mental level. Now remember, at the mental level, it's a world of very high-grade occasions that are certainly in universal telepathic contact with each other. And as Sri Aurobindo puts it, the beings at the high level of the mental world create matter by hidden stress of mind. Right? So there's a certain way in which these mental beings are creating matter out of their own designs in some way. Right? So these very powerful beings, and they don't work with time and space in anything like the way that we do. So I've been generally emphasizing in this class the linear nature of time, because there is something important that's linear about time. And because in emphasizing the linearity, I'm able to create a smoother sense of how these ideas apply to everyday life and to physics. But many people, including particularly Michael, have brought up the fact that the time probably really isn't linear, and that it's actually much more complex in some way that's, for me, would be a loss to really open that up. I mean, that's a whole project that needs to be opened up, is the alternative logics of time. But, for example, we can imagine that time proceeds linearly, but then if the soul wants to incarnate itself in some earlier moment, it might branch off a tangent starting a new universe, right? So that's one way we can imagine things. But there are so many ways we can imagine them, right? That we just don't, that obviously a straight linearity of time is way too high an abstraction to be fully adequate. Now, at the mental level, time is at its least linear. And so, for example, if you read the Seth material, I haven't read a lot of it, but what I have read, it claims to come from the mental level of consciousness, and it describes these complex non-linearities of time in various ways.
Which material is that?
What?
I'm sorry, what are you
The
talking?
Seth material. Okay. You know what that is? It was a series of books by someone named Roberts.
Jane Roberts.
Jane Roberts. And she was channeling an entity by the name of Seth. And they're interesting. They're provocative. Yes. You know, I never quite know how to evaluate those things, but that stuff sounds intelligent. And it gives you a pretty strong sense of this highly complex temporal structure that might be going on deeper than our linear structure, which is kind of an abstraction from it. So at the mental level, during the magical consciousness, there's the possibility of binding time in ways that are very unfamiliar to us. So like one thing I've emphasized is that the magical consciousness and the mental mutation have a lot to do with synchronicity. Because I've been wanting to claim that actual occasions, which are the building blocks of the actual world, are each and every one of them a synchronicity, in the sense that each actual occasion is a meaningful coincidence of the past. Right? That's this remarkable coherence of the present moment. And all other forms of causation are derived by abstraction from synchronicity. You know, so whereas Jung talks about synchronicity as an acausal connecting principle, I would call it the ur-causal connecting principle, the main one around which everything is related, right? So then we have, for example, an actual occasion, which is a synchronicity, and another actual occasion, which is a synchronicity. Each one of them takes in its entire world, right? But this one is hot, and this one ignites. So we have a little thing of efficient cause. I'm just crude, right? But the point is that efficient cause is a study of certain specific relationships among successive synchronicities. And if each one of these moments weren't already a mandala, wasn't already fully coherent and understandable, then it would be impossible to abstract out the factors which constitute chains of efficient causes. Right? Now, we also know from quantum mechanics that these efficient causes don't have to operate in the immediate future. They can sort of go off into the Schrodinger wave equation, whatever the hell that means, and manifest sometimes later in the future, right? So what I'm imagining about the Aboriginals, for example, is that they have found out a deeper and more fundamental way of working with the relationship between successive synchronicities. Right, so we're obsessed with these highly abstract analyses in terms of efficient causes. But they somehow got that creating the event of shooting the antelope made it inevitable that another synchronicity of shooting the real antelope, as opposed to the sand antelope, would happen. Because they understood something deeper about the connection between various synchronistic moments as they occur through time. And so for them, in a certain sense, shooting the sand antelope in the neck and shooting the flesh antelope in the neck are the same moment, somehow synchronistically bound together through a principle which we have lost, which has gone into our unconscious. Why? Because we, have become so hypnotically focused on the high abstractions through which our culture organizes experience that we've lost track of the deeper layers of causality that are actually operative in our lives. Right? And so this mental is a very, very high form of understanding. Now, we say it's latent in the magical. What does that mean? I think it means that in some way, in the waking world, it's poorly expressed. It's latent here in the waking world, even though it's the fundamental logic that's operating the system. Yeah.
So I think what we were talking about was more like the mental there as opposed to the mental there in terms of the latency of the...
This mental. Yes. Let me go through this.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So what I want to point out here is that we have some kind of principle of synchronistic causality. Now this also, by the way, what I'm talking, this is one of the lectures I wanted to get to, and this anticipates our lecture on thumbless technology a little bit. Okay, so I really wouldn't want you to think about this form of causality, because most of us have experienced magical causality at some point, right? Most of us had an experience at some point where making a decision and having the decision accomplished were the same act. It just feels that. Right? I must have told you, did I tell you guys my one example about my wife was pregnant? Okay, so my wife is pregnant, and I get this call at work. She's at the doctor's afraid that the baby's too small. She has to go in for a sonogram. I'm a first-time father, big panic, right? So I hop in my car, I'm driving across LA. I get off the freeway, and my car just stops working, right? So I manage to drift a momentum into a gas station. And I'm in a state of high panic, right? And all of a sudden, something happened in me. And I was already at the hospital. It was like I just felt it. It was like all the anxiety disappeared. It was like I had brought in some magical power, and the hospital was already there, right? And so I got out of my car, and I went to the next person I saw. I asked them to drive me to the hospital, and they did. But that seems obvious in some way, right? But the feeling I had was that I had magically accomplished it. Like it was already done. All the anxiety left, there was no worry, right? And I think that's a kind of principle of causality that's available to us. Now here's another example of it that Gebser gives. And again, I don't know exactly how reliable Gebser is, and Laura's going to hopefully check this out for us and see how seriously we can take him, but he tells the story about people going to be healed at Lourdes. And he describes how they go down into the cavern, and there's water there, and the statue of the Great Mother, and it's all dark, and they all hold hands. And so they regress, he says, into a magical consciousness. And in the magical consciousness, there is no differentiation among egos. Our magical ancestors did not have separate egos. They probably had a sort of a tribal ego, but no separate ego at all, right? So then people go down into Lourdes, and they all hold hands, and let's say one of the people in the group has a withered arm that never grew properly. And then they all finish their ceremony, and they come out, and the arm is perfect. Right? Now let's assume that's true, and Gebser didn't make it up, okay? Because we've heard other stories like that. In this case, obviously, the type of magical unity which the people were able to achieve under those conditions brought about a situation in which there were no individual egos, but also in which there were no individual bodies and no individual arms. And so the whole system fixed the broken arm, and the person came out with a whole arm. Now, physics would not make that possible, except in this tiny way. Quantum physics has now secured for us the fact that the physical world is not deterministic, right? And therefore, everything that happens is probabilistic, and mind is that factor which makes the difference in how these things happen, right? And so therefore, for example, the scientists now claim that there's a very, 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 very remote chance that I might let this go and it would levitate. Right? Because nothing is actually predicted. Okay, so my suggestion to you is that there is immense power in this kind of magical consciousness, reaching the mental level of our of the subtle worlds, and operating from there to bring about configurations of circumstances in the world in ways that have nothing to do with arranging sequences of efficient causes. And that this is an actual causal power, immensely powerful, more powerful than all the energies unleashed by physics, is the energy of human beings concentrating their attention in the unity of the mental world and intending something to happen, which causes it in its own unique synchronistic way. And I think that this learning to recognize and to consciously utilize this level of magical power is a very important part of the technology of the transphysical worlds. Okay. Any questions about that? Does that make sense? Can you get some feel for that?
Yeah. So that mental is more of a synchronistic causality, and that mental is more of an efficient causality?
I'll get to that.
Okay.
Now, then we have the astral level, right, which is mythical. Now, these two really fit well together because they're both dreamlike, right? In the mythical world, in the mythical structure of consciousness, reality is experienced as a dream. There really is a very little difference between waking dream and sleeping dream for the mythical peoples, right? They just flow right into each other. There are polarity, life and death, waking and dreaming. They just drift back and forth. There's no huge difference. And in the astral world, there's another form of causality, which I will call symbolic causality. Now, I've been referring to this in the book under the name of formal resonance. Right? And so, for example, in the Middle Ages, there was a revival of this kind of magic, and they said, okay, if you want to get a girlfriend, then you should wear a copper amulet, because copper is sacred to Venus. And if you want to be more powerful, you should wear whatever it is that's the sacred stone of Jupiter, and so forth and so on, right? So there's this idea that if we arrange things symbolically, that actually has powerful causal effects on the arrangements of circumstances that we experience. Now, we all know this because it's used in various deficient ways in the modern world. For example, dress for success is an example of symbolic causation, right? And advertisers use this a lot, right? Associating symbols to create changes of behavior. And churches, of course, right? All church ceremonial and so forth, right? And so the modern day churches have become completely deficient, and they've lost the understanding of the magical power that could be infused into their actions. But the fact is that through ceremonial enactments, not only do we create rapport and empathy and a sense of social solidarity, extremely important. But by symbolic enactments, we can focus our attention, thereby bringing in some of this synchronistic causality, and we can make things happen. You know, it's like we all know, among psychotherapists, for example, it's well known that if you're depressed, nobody's going to call you for it to be your new client. Then when you get cheerful, the phone starts ringing again. It's just the way it is, right? It's also known to psychotherapists that you're going to get clients, whatever issue you're working on, your clients are going to come in working on the same issue, right? So it's part of the spiritual practice of psychotherapy, right? But these are not causal events, right? They're more symbolic resonance that's going on in the world. And so that the actual quality of our lives, I mean, our lives, in our life, we don't move through physical spaces so much as we move through situations, right? We're in the waking world, not the physical world, and the waking world is thoroughly permeated by the transphysical world. And so we are walking through these complex situations in which we're not just physical bodies, we're also astral bodies and mental bodies. And so these forms of causality have enormously powerful effects in the waking world, right? So if we as human beings in this room, let's say, are a telepathic network and an empathic network and a physical network, all interpenetrating across, you know, vertically and horizontally, right? This is a very complex situation. And in this situation, what we feel and what we think is at least as determinative, really more so, than whether we pick our fingernails or not, right? I mean, those are the things that really matter, right? And so it's in the cultivation of these forms of causality that, and this form of causality, that we begin to find a kind of technology for an integral era, right? Finally, then, of course, we have the physical. Now, what's really interesting, and this is what's really unfortunate, is that what we call the mental mutation is actually the discovery of the physical world. So the fact that this has the same name as this is very confusing and unfortunate in our understanding, right? Because what happens is that here at the, when we come down, this is all a descent, right? From the mental to the astral to the physical, right? It's at this point that our consciousness, for the first time, really focuses down into the physical body. Right? And at that point, we begin to apply our mentality to an understanding of the physical world. Right? It's with the mental mutation that there's the first discovery of physical space. Right? Space as a neutral environment in which things happen is totally different from dream space, in which every inch is symbolically significant, right? And so it's only with this descent into the physical that we get what Gebser calls the mental mutation, right? So if you look at it from the Sri Aurobindo way, the mental's on top. If you look at it from the Gebser way, the mental's on the bottom, right? I have to write this up somewhere because it's important.
Can I say that last thing again? Sure.
With Sri Aurobindo, he uses the word mental for the highest level. Gebser uses the word mental for the lowest level. And so it's confusing as we try to reconcile the two systems.
But aren't the mutations like evolving?
What?
Aren't the mutations evolving from magical to mental?
Yeah, but they're devolving, in my opinion.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I consider this an involutionary movement,
a departure.
From the privileged state. The archaic is the privileged state.
Is that the high, would that be a higher state than mental, the archaic?
Well, wait a minute. Yeah. Archaic is up here. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what's here at this moment to correspond. I haven't thought it through that far.
Sorry.
But that's okay. But what I want to say is this, is that the archaic represents some kind of state of fusion with nature and God in some way. All of this represents a departure in, well,
oh, yeah,
right?
Separation.
A separation, an increasing alienation. And so what you get as you descend is you get ideas of increasing scope and generality.
Abstract.
Highly abstract, but you get a diminishment of intimacy with God and nature. And so this is this sort of double movement. It's both an expansion of intellect, but an actual spiritual descent into darkness.
So we're about to further devolve into the integral age.
Well, the idea is that it's a cycle, right? And so we go back into the archaic at a higher level of the spiral.
Yeah, the archaic is the integral of the next octave.
That's right. The integral is the next octave of the archaic. Right, and so that would probably imply that, in fact, it would certainly apply that we'd be working with over-mental and super-mental here in the archaic. Yes, Lynn?
Just to clarify, are there two different kinds of evolution in a sense? Because our biological evolution has occurred along the magical to mythical to mental. But yes. The evolution, like for Sri Aurobindo, is ongoing.
First of all, those mental to mythical to mental, I mean, magical to mythical to mental is not biological evolution. It does not involve any genetic shifts. It's not a biological phenomenon. But it's rather part of what Sri Aurobindo calls the human cycle. In other words, within human existence, at our current level of genetic development, this cycle plays out. Right? And so it's not evolutionary. It's a cycle that takes place at the biological human level.
I'm not sure I totally agree with that personally, but yeah, I mean, I think that sort of takes the sort of genetic deterministic dominant paradigm in molecular biology and sort of reifies that and doesn't pay any attention to epigenetics and some of the research they're showing that actually people that are at different levels of consciousness and having different states of consciousness, that it's actually having profound effects on their DNA. And the DNA is functioning much more like a fluid, non-linear network, and the configurations are enacting particular traits rather than a particular gene, in a linear causal sequence leading to something. So there,
That's a big clarification. I hadn't thought about that, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. But it's sort of.
I would like to dialogue a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So I totally see the value of what you're saying, and I'm quite sure now that you said it. All the things in my mind that these shifts in consciousness would bring about differences in the way the genetic structuring is expressed, which are different from the mutation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so what's interesting, what Sri Aurobindo says, which I think still survives your criticism, and let's see, right? He says that once we get to the basic genetic level of humans, then humans become possible. It becomes possible for human beings like us to incarnate the divine fully. In other words, we are sufficiently developed biologically to do that. However, he also says that what happens at the human level is that the driver for evolution shifts. So that up until the human level, the driver for evolution is external events. Whereas from the human point forward, the driver of evolution is yoga or spiritual development. And so he would then be quite happy with the idea that spiritual development would affect the way the genes are expressed and how they communicate and so forth and so on. So that would bring our ideas together.
Yeah.
But thank you, that's a very good point.
Yeah. We're in this linguistic problem where we're talking about science from a traditional science perspective, and as long as we do that, it doesn't allow it to evolve into its integral perspective. And then when it does that, then if you create this polarity or a polemic between that, then you lock yourself. Yeah, you don't allow science to evolve.
Exactly. And so it is. We're playing around. We drift into scientific ideas, and we forget to translate them to the integral. But still, what you said was a really interesting point. Who's that? Bill. I can't see. Oh, Bill. Hi, Bill.
I'm going to bring WD-40 in here and spray
it. That way you can come anonymously.
Yeah, sort of.
So when you say that humans are sufficiently evolved that they can begin to bring in Godhead and work inwardly, is that the main difference? Because I've been asking these questions. What are the fundamental differences between us as humans and other beings? Because the fact that we see ourselves as different or privileged doesn't make sense to me. Because we should all be able to be described the same way, but somehow we've just, actual occasions of higher grade, we're using some skills that others have not developed yet. So it's like a physical, biological evolution in our beings that make us able to do this?
Well, you see, Sri Aurobindo talks about there being two parallel evolutions going on, an evolution of form and a soul evolution. They're both going on simultaneously.
Right. So that's what I was asking about before, but that seems like there's two different evolutions.
Yeah, this is not the same one. I don't think it's the same two ones we were looking for last time. But he's saying that, you know, the world evolves, atoms evolve, galaxies evolve, and so forth and so on, right? But as that's happening, and really that's all happening in response to a soul evolution. And so from his point of view, the soul, which is living in the secret cave behind our hearts in each one of us, and is somehow an outpost of the divine, is driving us in an evolutionary way through our instinct for the true, the good, and the beautiful. And that it is working, it has been working throughout the evolutionary process to perfect vehicles capable of expressing its richness. And that when we reach the human level, the vehicle is essentially capable of expressing the soul's richness. Now, you asked me another question I didn't quite answer.
I don't remember. But can we say some fundamental characteristics about humans that are different?
Yes,
is it
yes.
that we have free will?
No.
We no longer.
The free will goes all the way down.
Not that kind of free will, not the free will inherent in every occasion, but that we have a free will that we can actually imbalance a situation as opposed to operating more in harmony with...
No, I don't think so. I think that that's possible all the way down also. But there are a couple of things that I think are different. And I think one of the main things is that the evolution is an evolution out of ignorance into knowledge. And that the knowledge into which we're evolving is the knowledge of the divine, the knowledge of the ultimate grand. And that human beings with the gift of language are able to bring that factor into consciousness in a way that other entities can't. And so I would say that probably the most unique characteristic of humanity is its ability to think self-consciously about the divine. And that's really what a lot of the real issues about. Now, we also have opposable thumbs, which is really interesting. And now, Pete Russell, your friend, he has a theory that whenever a species develops opposable thumbs, it is doomed to extinction because it will just create the kind of crisis that we're creating. I don't agree with Pete on this particular point because we didn't do this for the last 400 years. We've been around for at least a million, right? So we obviously have the capacity not to do this. And I like to think of thumbs as making us into God's gardeners, right? Just that we got messed up along the way with our understanding of what's going on and misused our thumbs. So I don't think thumbs do much to extinction, although it's not entirely an implausible thought. What was I talking about?
Characteristics of humans.
Oh yeah, so I think the main thing is the spiritual development. I think really that's what the main thing is that we have developed a capacity. You know, we act like, because we can explain atoms without having to invoke God, we think that we've disproven the existence of God, right? But of course, atoms don't respond to God. The more evolved the being is, the more it responds to divine impulses. So why would we think that because the atoms don't know God, it's not real, right? We evolved to the point where we can know something about God, which makes us more evolved. And at this particular moment, I'm sure there are other things I'd want to say at different moments, but at this moment, that's what comes up as this really distinctive feature of human existence. Michael.
I was thinking of the notion of the parallel evolutions, and it seems like it's not actually being on Sri Aurobindo's system seen as parallel if nothing happens in the physical without the involution of the mental. It seems the way I would understand the movement of parallel lines is neither can move without the other, else they're not parallel. Almost as if they're the same line.
Yes, that is a logically valid point. And I believe that Sri Aurobindo would say that the evolution could happen without any intervention from above because all the knowledge and wisdom and compassion of Satchidananda is packed into the quantum vacuum but eventually come out. But that it's much more rapid and fast because of the pressures from the upper planes. But you're right, it's not really parallel. I think I actually want to go even further in agreeing with you. I think he would say...
Well, I believe it is really parallel.
That it is really parallel?
Yeah.
In what sense?
In the sense that... it just seems to me that... I think that's a synchronistic way of understanding. I keep going back to the word coincidence.
Right.
And you said synchronistic succession, which didn't make sense to me in terms of coincidence. It seems like the profound idea in synchronicity is things happening at the same time, or the quantum idea of an object in two places at once.
Yeah, so are you... Time. Are you arguing for a kind of parallelism between mind and body?
Strict parallelism.
Yeah, that came up a lot at that conference the other day on realism. This was the idea, I think they have speculative realism. It has this idea, I think they call it the idea of, was it concordance?
Correlationism.
Correlationism, right? Which is the idea that there's just a correlation between mind and matter. They're somehow separate but correlated. There's a very large school of thought. What?
I heard that also, but I don't like that either.
So how would you say it, exactly?
I think it's beyond correlative. It's literally the same.
Ah, but that's very different. That's not parallelism at all.
I think that...
That's totally different.
Parallel lines cannot tell each other
what?
Apart. It's almost like the
that
same
what?
Line. Two parallel lines aren't actually two lines. So it's not correlative. It's actually the same line. Can't tell two parallel lines apart.
Well, let me
ask you.
What are the two parallel lines here? I'm not quite getting you. What are the two parallel lines we're talking about?
The mental and physical aspects, or just even two parallel lines geometrically.
Well, okay, well, I'm going to stick to that. That's an analogy, right? I mean, two parallel lines are two lines, they're not one line.
There are two lines because of the plane above that you're looking down at them from. I'm speaking of how the two parallel lines would experience themselves.
I don't see that particular move you're making when you're trying to show me that two parallel lines are from some perspective one is not registering on me.
Well, didn't you use the same exact argument when you said that for two points to be different, they had to be unique, they had to be different?
Yes, but of course two parallel lines are quite different because you get them by starting with one line, drawing a point outside of that line, and then drawing another line. And so they're clearly distinct, and they're defined as distinct, and so I don't see why they would collapse. But anyway, let's stay with mind-body. I don't want to get involved in geometry because it's less interesting. Let's talk about the mind-body and your idea that somehow they just move along together. That's a mental idea. It's been dominant in sciences for decades and decades in many parts of science. For me, it's a way of evading the issue because it implies that there is a difference between mind and matter, and also in the mental way, this mental way, the Gebserian sense, it implies that that mind and matter are related as inside and outside. So they go along together. One's the inside, one's the outside, but they're
both
just together.
Inside and outside. That's
you can do that, but still, there's still now. But whereas I want to say is that distinction between mind and matter is not spatial, but temporal. So that matter is always in the past, and consciousness is always in the present. Right, and so then they're no longer parallel at all.
I would find no distinction whatsoever.
Well,
all the way down.
I'm implying that there's an analytic distinction, but no ontological distinction. We may be saying the same thing.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Does that that way of viewing it, does that imply that so at any moment, let's just say like a high grade actualization of human being. Does that mean that a human being can't really connect with another subject in the moment because they're always whatever they're pretending is an object?
Yes.
From the past?
Yes.
So does that then therefore deny the possibility of authentic inner subjectivity in the moment?
Well, first of all, this is a very complex and rich question. So first of all, if we just stay strictly with Whitehead, we're always experiencing the immediate past. However, that does not mean we don't have incredibly deep subjectivity, because I'm experiencing the experience that you just had. So in principle, in Whitehead, I can be as close to your experience as I am to my own experience a second ago. That's a lot of intimacy that's possible, right? So it's not exactly alienating. Secondly, there's something else I want to say that I lost. But secondly, there is, of course, the whole factor of non-locality and the coincidence of the inside and the outside, which suggests that, in fact, my moment of immediate subjectivity actually isn't separate from yours. Right? So that we are all emerging together out of a single ground, makes multiple decisions. So there's that even deeper intimacy. But then there's some way in which the finite experiences we have coming out of that ground get communicated. And even that's not really alienating, because the whole experience is flowing in. But the idea that, you know, we've talked about the lake cone idea. Right? Well, this is the present moment, and this is the whole past, and this is the whole causal future, right? And then we have all these contemporary occasions. I forgot what I want to say. I'm very spacey this morning. What were we just talking about? Intersubjectivity.
Present.
Yeah, so it's, in a certain sense, all of these things are having an influence at every moment. Except these, of course, because that hasn't happened.
Right?
And so there's it's a tremendously intimate, you know, I know what I wanted to say. I remember what I wanted to say. Let me start again. We got the light coming. And because right here, none of the contemporary occasions are having a direct causal effect on this, that's why it has a moment of absolute freedom. Right? Because it does have, on the exoteric level, on the relativistic level, it is not having, its actual decision is not being caused by any of its contemporaries. Like right now, as I'm deciding what to say, it's a free decision. Because at this very moment, although I'm affected by all of what you were feeling an eighth of a second ago, I'm not affected by you right now, and so I have a moment of freedom, right? So that's one of the advantages you get from looking at it this way. And you may lose intimacy, although I'm not sure you really do, because you end up with an incredibly interfused universe where experiences are just, there's nothing but the sharing of experience in the whole universe. It's all intersubjective. But you do get this moment of isolation, which is this quantum of freedom in which we make free decisions. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Denise?
When he was talking about his parallel line idea, I've been thinking a lot about things being in tune and how everything works that way. And if you think of two parallel lines as like an interval, it can be, I mean, two notes are always in relationship. And so, like, you could say A has to be at 440, but that's just an arbitrary thing. In Europe, they tune the orchestras to A 446, so that's an arbitrary thing. But when they're with another note, to be in tune, you can hear the beats in between. They're always in relationship. So to me, what he's saying about the two parallel lines being one is that in between that they have to work out to stay in parallel.
Sure, of course.
So it's
they have a relation, but they have a constant relationship between them.
So they're separate, but like an interval, one note isn't anything without something else to relate it to.
You can play one note, but the point is this: is that you have two notes with a constant interval. No problem.
So to me, that's what.
But that's not the same thing as saying one note. It's two notes with a constant interval.
I think the space in between is sort of an inversion of the mind itself. It's not, there's nothing, like I said, I'm doing a thought experiment here where I'm trying to see it from the perspective of the parallel line. And from the perspective of the parallel line, that space in between makes no sense.
Well, to begin with, I'm not sure we could talk about seeing from the point of view of a parallel line, because a parallel line is an abstraction and doesn't have a point of view.
It does in Flatland.
What?
That's exactly what I'm thinking. I mean, I've been thinking, you know, the book from the, what was the guy named Abbott who wrote the book from Flatland, right? And so I've been trying to think of it from that perspective, you know, where, and there's a thing where if you're looking head on the plane at the parallel lines, they're not lines, they're points. And then if you're looking from the side, they're one. And so I'm not sure where you're going with this, but I kind of appreciate the humor in it and the
Yeah, but to look at it from the side to say they're one is to confuse an ontological distinction with a perspectival distinction, and it's just irrelevant. Period. You know, the point is,
go those places, trust me.
Well, they are one from one dimensional perspective. And then
you know, this conversation seems to me to be utterly pointless. I just don't get why we're talking
about it. No, it's infinitely
It's linear. It's a linear conversation.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, did you have a point? I mean, I'm totally interested in what you're saying. I was wondering, is there like a...
Thank you, Michael.
Only to suggest that what linear time suggests is that first there's one and then there's the other. And that's where I think the outside-inside distinction comes from. I want to suggest a different kind of distinction.
Yeah.
Not boundary, but horizon. I think you can't separate... an event happening is two poles coming together. That's how we understand synchronicity. Right. So, we can still draw relationships, but each thing, the thing was not prior to the relationship, it is the relationship.
I just don't know what you're saying. I'm sorry. You know,
I'm saying there's no such thing as the mind. Spinoza says the mind is the idea of the body.
Yeah,
I think that's helpful. Just to say that they come together. My idea of this cup is overlaid on the cup. There is no way that I can suggest something other than the cup. They're the same activity to me. There's no entity called mind or entity called body that are different. I understand them as a relationship to each other.
You know, the thing is, I guess what's happening is that you are articulating a philosophical perspective that's so unfamiliar to me that I just don't know how to deal with it. And I'm not in any way suggesting it isn't valuable, because I see how smart you are and I see how articulate you are. But I just keep having the experience that you're saying things that are just so alien to my way of understanding that I'm not able to grasp them quickly enough to give you any kind of response in class.
I'm not looking for
it. Okay. Anyway, so I apologize for that.
I think it's interesting.
Yeah, so I really want you to know that I really honor you. I just don't understand you. So that's the problem. And hopefully over time we'll get better at it.
I just wonder if it's an articulation of some kind of a more of a magical unity, a magical interrelatedness that
I'd like to see it spelled out so I can have a chance to work with it more.
I made a chart in my last few.
Maybe I can do some spelling here. I'm not sure if this will contribute, but I've been reading some of the latest interpretations and experimental work in quantum mechanics on issues of non-locality and wave function collapse and all that kind of stuff. And it's really changed the picture that I have had of quantum mechanics. And basically, what I'm getting is that there's sort of two perspectives. Same thing, and this bears on the mind-body problem. Basically, the universe, if you look at the whole thing, abstractly from physics ideas, is just these evolving wave functions with possibilities in them and probabilities. And there is never any collapse. It's so from the universal point of view, everything is cross-connected, everything is entangled, everything is coupled, everything, the whole universe is coherent, meaning anything you do to one part affects another.
That makes sense.
Right. Now, the problem in quantum mechanics is you do these measurements and you find specific things. So that's like the body part. You just talked about the mind part. You could say it's like the wave nature of matter, or wave nature of things. And there's this phenomena called decoherence, which is an attempt to explain the classical and quantum boundary, which is, in this idea, would be the mind and body in a way, because mind is transphysical, parts of body are transphysical, and so forth. So, and what they're saying in decoherence, which Bohm started actually to take seriously and do math on, is that the superposition of things, when it interacts with a measurement apparatus, you can look at it, you can have a wave function for the measurement apparatus, and the wave just comes in and mingles with the other one and entangles. Basically, now you have a wave function that describes both of them together. And depending on what the other has some other state that it takes, there's no superposition. Okay, so decoherence is not a sort of blind collapse about which nobody has any, we just know we're stuck with these two places they have to be and how do you interconnect. So the wave function approaching the wave function of the measuring apparatus is low dimensional. It could be a photon with polarization states and a few other things, not complicated. Then when it reaches the measurement apparatus, the measurement apparatus is at some stage has to become macroscopic for people to read the dials. And the two wave functions from the universal point of view just interact, and there's a continuing wave function. Everything's on non-local and heavily correlated or entangled. And so there just is no, it's all mind.
But how do they get macroscopic?
Okay, so what they've done is a lot of interesting work on the equations and so forth. And the idea is that you can consider, for practical purposes, you know, that's where they need philosophy always, that effectively what happens is the simple wave function interacts with something macroscopic, which is enormously high dimension. It's like six dimensions for a moving particle, plus some spins and stuff. So. And, you know, so it's mind-bogglingly large. And when the interaction happens, the superposed states get all sucked up into the complexity of the measuring device. And it has the effect, if you look at it statistically, of making the correlation between the original objects not measurable, not visible. So it's a matter of appearance. If you have a local perspective, then you see this stuff happening.
You know, I'm going to ask us to stop this now because I'm sure most of us are barely following.
Okay.
And, well, I want to talk to you more about this a lot, but I just don't think, I think it's not fair to the class.
Sure.
It's just too many abstruse concepts.
Is that right?
Am I right? What?
I'm interested.
Okay, well, go on. If you're interested, then go on.
I have my own little story about what you're saying.
Okay. Well, let's go.
Well, I think I'm almost done.
Okay.
So that's what I want to understand about Bohm, how the appearance makes the measurement.
Yeah, but of course, where does the appearance come from? You see, this is...
Appearance is this decoherent.
You still haven't really told us what that
means. Okay, right. These are just models of it. So you're asking, what is...
Decoherence.
Incoherent.
Just decoherent.
Just decoherent.
Define decoherence.
Yeah, define decoherence.
Okay. All right. Decoherence is when the superposition is lost, when there's no longer correlations.
That's the collapse, right?
Yes, this is a way to talk about collapse, but not as an imagined, golly gee, the whole wave function disappears into a thing.
Instead, it has something to do with the complexity.
and information and measurement issues. I mean, all the time we use statistics because there's no fucking way we can measure what's going on in detail and things. So,
well, again, this is one of those physics stories that is interesting.
But there's always non-locality from the universal point of view.
Right.
And there's not loss of interference times. So if you're a god, that's what this sort of says. It's a vague model of God here. Because here we are in the physical world, stuff comes to us, strange probabilities, God, who makes that decision. But from God's point of view, if you crank the math, you have it all there. And so the locality itself is an issue of appearance, of this effective, beyond anything you can measure.
Well, so here's the problem.
It's like the wave nature of this chair. It's one of these,
scientific stories, right, where you, like, somehow or other, or there's sort of this thing like, or, and it's like appearance. Suddenly this new term comes in, appearance, and I have no clue how you're going to generate appearance out of a universal wave function, or centralization of consciousness, or... You're telling me a story that sounds like it has some piece of something.
Okay.
But I just,
because you would want to take into account the whole hierarchy of grades, including...
Well, even just, I want to know what an appearance is. How could you possibly get an appearance? And who could it be appearing to if the world is nothing but a wave function?
It's both. That's a famous paradox in all spirituality, right?
Right, but I want to die as a philosopher. I don't want to just leave it as a paradox. I want to say something.
I think there's a lot of detail in here.
Okay, well, maybe you could do a class on this. We can all kind of, maybe we can set that up.
I'm working on it.
Okay.
Cool.
Yeah.
Can I just, this may be just completely off base or completely separate, but when I'm listening to him speak, I'm hearing it as, like, Whitehead. An appearance, an actual occasion. So I'm hearing it as the undifferentiated God. What God sees is like the infinite actual occasion, which I'm assuming that the experience that actual occasion takes in is always the entire objectivity. It's not abstracted in any way. It's the whole picture. But then anytime you come in with a local or a finite actual occasion, it has to abstract from that reality, and that's what the appearance is.
Yeah, that's very nice.
So those are the words that are not the same words.
Right, but then the point is that he's talking about a physics story, right? So he's saying the universe consists of a Schrodinger wave function. Whatever the hell that is.
No, that's an abstraction. I understand this.
And then out of that, somehow there's an appearance, right? Now, if you want to start with actual occasions and then explain the quantum wave phenomena in terms of that, that'd be really interesting.
I got you.
But the other way around, I'm unsatisfied.
Not your philosophical analogy.
I just have a brief analogy of decoherence.
Yeah.
It says, a useful metaphor to help explain the dynamics of decoherence is to liken the quantum wave function to the waves of a body of water, the ocean perhaps. When viewed from the air, the waves far from the shore are seen to arise and propagate in coherent patterns as a connected progression of waves in motion rather than a series of discrete entities. However, to an observer on the shore, waves appear to come in one at a time and to deliver a new load of water with each new wave crest. Thus, it is the fixed location of the shore interacting with the moving waves that breaks them into individual units.
Yeah, well, see, that's all great. But then my question is, where did the damn shore come from if you're in a universe of evolving wave function?
Well, you would have to be...
the actual occasion that's taking it.
Well, that would do it. No, I agree, but I want to hear Bill develop a theory in which he expresses what he's saying in terms that are coherent with what we're saying here so we can get some understanding of what it means. Because if he could do that, he could write the best book yet on quantum physics, right? So...
I wouldn't have thought it that way. Those guys are not going to be interested.
For the rest of us.
Where my mind goes with that, which maybe connects with what you were saying, Michael, is that, to me, and it could be that I'm totally mishearing you, and this is just projecting my little story on it, but it sounds to me like an example of the ways that the methods that we use to participate with reality are actually constitutive of those realities.
That's right.
So it's an active universe.
Yeah, but then who are we? The point I keep trying to make is that in physics, you're trying to claim what the ultimate realities are. right? That's usually the way it works. So the idea that the world is made of matter. What's matter made out of? Well, in this new theory, matter is made out of an evolving a function of probabilities, right? Okay. Well, gee, okay. But then there's this idea that somehow this coherent body of waves has some shore to break on.
Well, that's time space, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. That's what I want to know.
Well, the shore.
And where does it come from?
The shore is in the
limitation
world,
on the divine.
Where did the classical world come from? From the quantum theory.
It's like I'm here and my awareness is limited. I have this personal perspective on things with all the sensory occasions, giving us filtered versions of things. That's where we get appearance and personal awareness. And yet, in enlightenment, you can understand that your personal awareness is absolutely continuous and seamless, separated from whatever the ground of being is.
See, let me talk about something here.
Well, can you tell us what the causation of the physical mental is? Is that efficient?
What?
You left out one causation, the physical mental.
Physical down here.
It's just physical causation.
Yeah, thank you. The problem we have here is a problem of deep incoherence.
You say incoherence or deep?
Incoherence. Deep incoherence. And I don't mean this in a bad way, but what I mean is that we have different bodies of thought that are motivated by different aims and that make completely different abstractions for different purposes. And then when we try to coordinate them, it gets really, really difficult, right? So I was thinking about this on the way here this morning. I was thinking how as the mental mutation, Gebser's mental mutation, dawned, as we began to move into polarizing our attention in the physical world, this created this whole new world of concepts, right? But this whole new world of concepts developed very differently in the West than it did in the East. And the differences are fascinating. Because the way I'm thinking about it today, and you need a better expert to see if you could validate this, but I think it's true, is that in the West, the distinction between consciousness and form was minimized. It wasn't even really recognized. I'm sorry. Yeah, consciousness and form, mind and form, were identified. So that, for example, Aristotle talked about how beings exist, individual beings, ousia, exist. And they exist because a form is expressing itself in substance. But consciousness was assumed to be the activity of the form in the substance. Right? And so consciousness and thought, consciousness and form in the West become equated. And that's, for example, reflected when you talk about the wave function as being somehow the basic thing, because that's nothing but form. It's formal properties, right?
Hold on. I always understand that. I'm just not bringing it up.
Oh, I know you understand. I get that. But now, in the East, a different distinction was made. And that's the distinction between pure consciousness and everything else, including all form and all matter. Right? So we made the distinction between form and matter and spent 2,500 years exploring it. They made the distinction between consciousness and everything else and spent 2,500 years exploring it. Now, what's the difference? The difference is a profound difference in aim. Right? The Greeks were profoundly extroverted people. At the beginning of the mental mutation, they asked, what is permanent about objects? What's permanent about the world? Right? But the Indians are deeply introspective, and so they said, what's permanent about me? What's permanent about experience? Right? As you can see, the same mental mutation expressing itself in these radically different ways. Right? Now, I think that's a really interesting example of it. But another interesting example of it is physics, right? So the thing about physics is that it's approached from the beginning with a certain aim, And the aim of physics initially is the analysis of macroscopic motion, the mathematical analysis of motion. Right now, so Einstein and Infeld wrote this great book called The Evolution of Physics. It's a marvelous book, as befits their intellects, right? And the book starts out by saying this: the essence of physics is the measurement of motion. And I looked at that and I thought, what the fuck? I mean, why would anybody think that the measurement of motion, macroscopic motion, would tell you anything important about reality?
Because appearance is motion.
What?
They see appearance as motion.
Well, it's actually...
red is a motion.
What is a motion?
According to physics, red is a motion.
Yeah, that's much later, right? But this began way before they got into that. They're basically talking about the movement of cannonballs, right? What? No, at the beginning of physics, they dismissed red as a secondary quality and said it was purely subjective, as you say. Right? So at the beginning, they're talking about the movement of cannonballs, basically, and clocks and inclined planes and falling objects. This is what it's all about, right? And so, you know, the King of England at one point was told that they had measured the speed of falling bodies, 32 feet per second per second, and he burst into hysterics. He said, what an absolute waste of time. Who could possibly care about something like that? He could have no conception of why it was even important, right? So somehow or other, we got into this idea, right, that the whole world consists of moving objects, and so analyzing the movement of objects becomes the most important thing in the world, right? And so you can see how there's this very narrow aim. Now, gradually, science begins to expand, right? And so it tries to take all the things that were secondary qualities and mathematize them as well, so it all becomes movement, right? And so physics becomes the attempt to analyze all of reality in terms of the movement, first of objects, and later of vibrations, right? That's the purpose. Now, it's a very narrow purpose and a very narrow set of initial ideas, right? Now, it goes on for so long that it begins to have all these interesting excrescences and paradigm shifts and so forth, right? And so pretty soon, physics starts to even talk about consciousness, because you get to quantum theory and somehow the mind of the experimenter becomes a crucial element in the experiment, and they get all mixed up and confused, right? Because their whole method is not designed to deal with consciousness from the get-go, right? And what's happened is that the aim of science, socially, has become completely caught up in the military-industrial, Congress-administrative complex that runs our society, right? And so the only things that scientists now consider real are the things you can reproduce in a laboratory and basically make money off of. Right? That's the actual criteria among a lot of people. Is it real means, can it be commercialized? Because if it's real, it can be commercialized. If it's not, it's irrelevant and it might as well not be real. Right? So you see, the aims that we have in mind, our purposes, our intentions, have a massive effect on the abstractions that we pull out. And the abstractions that have been pulled out of physics are, first of all, diminished by the history of physics and its tie-in with the industrial complex. But also, the tradition of physics has been not to ask big questions. Physics, and like all the sciences, has become more and more specialized. And so scientists, a good scientist, can tell you a huge amount about almost nothing, right? As opposed to someone like me, who can tell you a little bit about almost everything, right? But a scientist can tell you a great deal about something very small, right? And so the scientists don't bother coordinating their ideas with each other. And so they never put together a philosophy of how the world works. If you ask a physicist, I'll bet money on this, if you ask 9 out of 10 physicists, what is the physical world, they'll go blank. They won't have any idea how to answer the question. They've never thought of it. Because it's all so specialized, right? So Bill comes in, and Bill's doing philosophy, right? But he comes in with these specialized quantum ideas, and they're fascinating, and they seem to have philosophical implications, right? But it's so hard to evaluate them because they come out of this context and they're not really integrated into a larger scheme. And so we get these like beautiful little gems that just fall incoherently into no context. Right? Because the scientists aren't doing the work.
So what's the way forward?
The way forward is to do the work.
The way forward is to ask the big questions.
And we'll talk a lot more about the way forward. I would actually say, I'll talk about that after the break. Yeah, last question, we'll take a break.
I just want to briefly add that I really appreciate, you know, many of the points that you made and agree with many of them, but, you know, as is an ongoing issue for me in this class, I think it's important just for me to say that I think it's a very kind of narrow view of science that you seem to hold. That denies, you know, huge communities of amazing scholarship that's going on.
Like
so
what?
I'm worried that in this class there's
I really appreciate
form of science that we're getting going that is really kind of a stereotype.
Thank you. But just briefly, will you mention some of the stuff that I've been leaving out?
You know, there's stuff that's going on that I think really is moving in the direction that you're pointing to. For example, the movement of critical realism, primarily in Europe, understands that, like, it came out of philosophy of science. I think there's an understanding that, you know, we need a kind of speculative philosophy to create a kind of a priori foundation that we can start building up a meta-theory that can start to look at what is the systematic interrelationship between the insights of these various disciplines. And so, you know,
beautiful.
There is a trend towards specialization and fragmentation,
yes.
But there's also a trend towards transdisciplinarity, interdisciplinarity,
yes.
Seeing the importance of integrating philosophy and metaphysics with empirical science and so on. So
it's
going on. And then there's also the social sciences. I think we often talk about science as this sort of positivist, hard, scientific kind of thing. But there's all kinds of social sciences that are going on that explore questions of meaning and big pictures. There's, you know, meta-sociology, that kind of stuff. So.
Thank you.
Just a few thoughts.
Thank you, Nick. Very, very important and very well appreciated that you say that. There's a lot of different ways people use the word science. It's one of those words. Right? So when I talk to scientists and say, what is science? They usually say it comes from the word scientia, which means knowledge. And so science is just knowledge. And then I say, well, when you have to pee, is that science? Because you know you have to pee. And they say, well, no, it's intellectual knowledge. And it goes on like that, right? So I personally, when I use the word science, in the critical way that I'm using it, have in mind science pre-quantum and science popular in the culture. And your point is absolutely well taken. I went to the panel on speculative realism, and I agree that what they're trying to do is important. I was appalled and disappointed, not by the students who gave magnificent presentations, every single one, but by the ideas they were presenting, which seemed so inane to me, and I couldn't figure out why anybody would try to develop speculative realism without reading Whitehead first. And he's done so much work that even if you want to disagree with him, you should know how he's transformed the problem so you can disagree with it. And so these guys were coming up with these crazy ideas, and every issue they brought up had been thoroughly analyzed and transformed by Whitehead. And they acted as if Whitehead had never even existed. So it was really strange to me, right? That they would, I love their impulse, I love where they're going, but I can't figure out why they wouldn't use the resources available to move them ahead a generation instead of messing around in the sand pile, you know. But you're right, there's a lot of good things going on, as what we're doing in this class is part of trying to advance science.
I have no problem with the way you're using it. I just think sometimes it's good to sort of pan out and go, that's a sort of technical definition of science, and we shouldn't totally conceive of science in that way.
I really appreciate your contribution.
Nick, wouldn't you say that the people doing the more integrative science would be have the same criticisms of Eric of the science, its fragmentation, and that's why they're trying to integrate it, or is that not the same?
That's what he's saying. So it's
just...
But they see themselves as, you know, continuous with the tradition of science.
Right. Okay, so let's take a break. Let's come back 20 after.
I think because we have a material privilege, and the way the chapters work out in my misassignment there, I do have in mind, if we were talking about Linda's question, about how to go forward in terms of values and so forth, but it's not that relevant either. So what I'm thinking we could do now is break up into our discussion section and see what that generates. And I'm wondering if anybody would like to suggest a discussions topic that might be a good topic for us to begin with in our discussions today. I mean, I suppose what I might be interested in, if you have an idea, is really to review what we've learned so far in the semester and try to see, you know, where it's clear and where it's confusing and what are some of the questions that we're being left with. And then if we can do that in the group, then that would also give me an opportunity to make sure I can address those questions in the next few weeks. So how about that? So let's do the groups, and let's consider them sort of a review discussion about what we've been doing the whole semester, and the particular intention of surfacing things that you still feel confused about. Okay? If you want to do the number thing again, so I'm going to start there.
Things for us to discuss.
Yes, Chris.
Well, something that came up in our group that was really into my paper is Whitehead's notion of linear time.
Yes.
And how actual occasions progress in relation to each other through linear time. And it's from what I've read, I read a paper by staff that involves more of a relativistic linearity, serial order, rather than everything compressing in one moment in time, or how did I describe it?
Are you asking about the relationship between actual occasions and time?
Sort of, and how they relate to each other. In one moment in time, are all actual occasions compressing at the same moment?
No.
Okay, so there's sort of a relativistic relationship between.
I know what you mean by relativistic, but they don't all happen at the same time.
They take different lengths of time.
They take different lengths of time, and they don't happen on any fixed cycle, as far as I can tell.
Okay, so the notion of now is kind of a.
Well, that's very interesting. Yes, the notion of now is a little bit lost, right? Because earlier on in the mental mutation, particularly the deficient mental, where time was considered represented as a line, and particularly up until Einstein, you could think that this line represented the present everywhere in the universe, right? And so now would be an exact cut.
Right.
You don't have that anymore.
Right.
To begin with, you've already lost that in relativity theory.
Okay, and he incorporates all of that.
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, there is no unique present in the same sense in relativity theory, and then, of course, there's all these issues of quantum unlocality, bringing in some notion of an instantaneous present, which nobody has adequately thought through, really, in terms of process philosophy and how that exactly works. So in a certain sense, everything's happening simultaneously. The now is simultaneous, but on the other hand, that now could include concrescences at every different stage of concrescence. So it's not as if, right? Mm-hmm. So the issue of the unique present moment is an issue that has been forcibly raised by quantum non-locality. So far, most scientists do not believe they can even reconcile that with relativity theory. Stapp believes that Tornaga Schwenger somehow solved that problem. Maybe they did, I don't know. But I've read whole books claiming the problem never was solved, so I'm not exactly sure. Right?
In the notion of, because he does involve a notion of linear time.
Yes.
In his theory. So if you were to picture such a thing, it would be kind of more of like a globular movement through time, with the past being solidified and the future being open. If you were to see all the actual occasions kind of moving together,
there'd be a sort of a past that's generally settled, mm-hmm. and a sort of a present region in which things are actually happening, mm-hmm.
and then a future in which things are probably undetermined.
And that line of the present is just
it's
where
a little
the fuzziness
little
is, or like
yeah, it's not an exact linear cut. It's mm-hmm. a little murky. It's got some thickness to it, and it's kind of
bubbly.
Bubbly, exactly. That's, by the way, exactly what Stapp would say. It's bubbly. That's mm-hmm. how his Toranaga Schwenger
okay.
idea comes out. Yeah. Okay. Any other interesting issues that came up?
Yeah, well, I get our question.
So, yeah, we were talking about kind of the possibilities when the concrescence prehends everything.
Yes.
And chooses between the possibilities.
Yes.
What happens to the possibilities that are not actualized?
Nothing. I can't imagine what happens to them. They cease to be relevant. The possibilities are generated by a situation. Something is chosen. The other possibilities that weren't chosen disappear with the situation of which they were a characteristic.
They would enter into history, into the past. You could say,
I have to think about it, maybe.
If I'd done this, if things would have been different. Or...
Yeah. So I guess it's possible. Now that's very interesting. Maybe the possibilities that weren't chosen become part of what's objectively immortal as unchosen possibilities. In fact, very good. Whitehead talks about the great negation somewhere. You know, he says that an occasion is significant partly by all the possibility that it cuts off, as much as by the possibility that it realizes.
I was about to say it creates meaning. It creates deeper meaning to hold on to the possibilities that you didn't have. It creates.
That's
otherwise,
right.
There's no meaning in the choices you made because what do they refer to? What's their relationship?
I stand corrected by Caleb. I'll now suggest that the unrealized possibilities become part of the objectively immortal past.
So when he says not being is a form of being, when I read that, it makes sense to me as far as the past.
Mm-hmm. Wait a minute, not being is a
he
form
says,
of being. In what context does he say that it's extremely important? Which book and which context?
It's an adventure of ideas, but he says not being in itself is a form of being. And what he's talking about is, well, I wrote my paper about the whole grand concept of the adventure of ideas of like an idea is birthed in an early part of history and
right.
then gets suppressed and
right.
it's not there, it's kind of latent
right.
and then it comes back.
Right.
So even though there aren't people actually actualizing that idea, it still is latent because it lives in our collective past.
Great.
So it comes in, so in that way not being is a part of being. Because it is existing in our collective past. But
if you want to call that not being, yes.
Right, so that's what I understood as what he was talking about. But then there's the other kind of not being
unactualized.
That actually is a choice that was considered
and rejected,
but it's there.
That's right.
As something that still might be considered for a future occasion in
another life
or whatever. Yeah.
Right, great questions. You know, this issue needs to be refined. And these are all excellent points that are being made.
Well, I'm just wondering, like, how you're going to distinguish then when you look upon your whole past for a new concrescence, and suddenly you don't just have all the things that actually happened in the past; you have all the possibilities that didn't happen too. So
that's right.
There'd have to be a distinguishing factor between which ones actually happened.
Yeah, the ones that happened were actual, and the ones that didn't happen are potentialities suggested by those actualities. It's very different. What's actual is different. What's actual is decided upon by consciousness. Actuality is one of our philosophical primitives here, right? Actuality is the result of concrescence. It's always, if it's finite in time and space, it's always involved in networks of efficient causation. That's what it means to be actual, to be part of the creative advance. Now, the creative advance, objectively immortal, stubborn facts of the past obviously are not just the possibilities that were realized, it was also the possibilities that were rejected. So, for example, I have a memory, as Caleb pointed out, of some moment in which I made some important decision. And then I remember that moment, and I wish I had made the other decision. Right? So the unchosen possibility is causally transmitted into the future, along with my prehension of the past actuality. You see, every actual occasion is characterized by a complex eternal object. And that complex eternal object includes both the things that it chose for and the things that it chose against.
But it's still one occasion.
Yes, it's still
okay,
one occasion.
So I was seeing it as every possibility
that I didn't choose
becomes some kind of an
occasion.
Oh, no. Which would be very confusing. So it's just inherent in the actual occasion.
That very confusing thing you're talking about is probably the quantum theory multiple worlds theory. But I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the memory of not having made the decision is also causally effective in the future, as well as the decision that I made. Right?
Right.
And so the unrealized possibilities remain characteristics of those occasions that didn't make them, and therefore those unmade decisions also become causally effective in the present. Thank you, Caleb. Yeah?
So, if it's in the past, So is the objectively immortal past eternal objects, eternal form?
Not just. It's the eternal forms, and it's what we're calling energy or experience.
Within the occasion itself.
So every occasion is characterized by form. Every occasion is characterized by form. Every transmission of energy is a transmission of experience, of formed experience through the creative advance. And so, just like, you know, electromagnetic energy versus gravitational energy, they're both energy, but they have a different form, right? And they each have both an intensity and a form. So in the same way, the energy objectified by an actual occasion has energy and form to it.
Did you say that the unchosen possibility becomes causal?
It is, yes. It's just like, you see, I'm saying that my entire experience, everything about it, is causal to the world around me. And that includes the decisions I didn't make.
But do you have to be conscious of those decisions that you didn't make?
No. However, the ones you're conscious of will have more causal power.
Because will those possibilities that you are conscious of, is that constitute a kind of actuality? Like it's like an idea in a sense that's coming into action, concressing?
I'm sorry, say it again.
I feel like I'm a little bit confused, but so that when there's this field of possibility and some of those possibilities you're aware of, and other possibilities you might not be aware of. The ones that you are aware of, do they constitute like the concressing of an occasion?
Well, the ones that we're aware of and the ones that we're not aware of are part of the concressions. So for example, in the way that my body interprets the world, there are countless decisions that are being made of which I am unaware. But all of that, then, creates a sufficiently complex situation that it generates my conscious awareness of it. And so at the end of the concrescence, particularly a high-grade concrescence, conscious decision-making becomes especially important. Right? And so it does seem pure speculation. I really can't justify this, but it sort of seems to me that those decisions that are made at the higher levels of the concrescence in full consciousness would be somehow more energetic and powerful than the ones that were made unconsciously. I'd have to justify that. I'm just saying it because it sounds right at this moment.
But it's almost there's something around it. If you're playing between different decisions, but they're both really conscious, and you're like, gosh, should I do this? And you keep contemplating it over again.
Right.
It's almost like you're
enacting this kind of whole trajectory, even if you're not acting on it. But there's some way that I would imagine that that becomes a stronger causal force in the presence of future.
Absolutely. Because in a certain sense, beautifully said, because every time I think about the decision, that's another occasion.
Yeah.
And that occasion...
Well, it's a conceptual occasion, right?
Yeah, it is actually, right? And but that occasion itself has causal effects. And so if I think about it often enough, you've all noticed this, right? If there's something you're thinking about doing, and if you think about it often enough, you'll eventually going to do it, right? So there's a sort of way that there's an accumulation of causal power, even for things we don't do at the moment.
And if for some reason
you've
been thinking about that for a long time, and a societal reason that you couldn't do it, it had to be suppressed.
Right.
Then the power it gains from having been suppressed and come up against resistance, Jung would say that would give it an archetypal kind of quality where it would burst through with a lot more power. So that some of these ideas in the past that maybe have been suppressed over time, once they kind of break through the society, could be a big enough fire to carry us into the integral.
Yeah. Sure.
You know?
Sure. Why not?
Isn't that kind of what his whole adventure of ideas theme was?
Could be.
Because the power and a general idea of complexity, people can't understand it. And so it doesn't take off in society until society catches up enough to be able to entertain the idea and to use the idea to create a new world.
Yeah, of course, that idea wasn't repressed exactly. So repression is something else.
Inquisition, Reformation.
I see.
There's kinds of ideas that were suppressed.
What you're describing is certainly a reality. It is certainly the case that certain things get repressed liberally. That is, there's a structure of consciousness which persistently makes the decision to negatively preempt those things over and over and over again. And number one, first of all, the things that we suppress become much more monstrous in our imaginations. Right? So, if you want to do some sexual thing and you're not doing it because it's not right, it'll become like this huge monstrous thing in your mind, right? Even if it might be really even pretty minor from a social point of view. So that's one thing. But secondly, sometimes these repressed things do in fact become really huge. Like, for example, whatever's breaking out in the Middle East now is some kind of deeply suppressed something or other that's just cataclysmically breaking forth. And so that's also possible.
Well, like shamanism and magical things that were repressed because the dominant Christian society didn't like
that's right.
That. And now maybe
that's right, although again,
enough explanation and people waking up to what
absolutely. Although there's, I wouldn't make that the sole explanation because you're also dealing there with mutations of consciousness. But it's still definitely part of what's going on. The return of the repressed, the return of the feminine, so forth and so on. This is a big dynamic. Because the fact is that every human world we create leaves a lot out. And the stuff that gets left out eventually presses for expression. And that's what breaks down the system. Absolutely.
I think it's hard. We like personify these actual occasion decisions, and we can get tripped up by not remembering that there's so many actual occasions because we're a higher grade. That there's so many actual occasions happening in the process of our actual decision making.
That's right.
And it can seem like these things aren't in order or they're simultaneous, but it's so many complex things happening.
It is, if you read
to make a choice, right?
It's huge.
The conceptual occasions that are occurring, the possibilities. Like I'm not even wanting to say that the possibilities that you never act on actualize as unactualized possibilities or something like that. I don't know. It's like this huge field of.
It's very You see, it's really complex. Now, if you look at process and reality, the whole middle section of process and reality is this exhaustingly detailed analysis of the process of concrescence, right? But really, I'm starting to understand how oversimplified it is, right? Because, he didn't even consider nonlinearity of time and some of these issues, right? So what we're opening up here is an approach, right? The working out of which is the work of many generations. There's so much work to be done here, right? But what we've got here is an approach that kind of makes sense, right? It allows us to do all these great things. It's an approach that lets us bring together psychology, occultism, spirituality, physics, sociology, like all into one metaphysical umbrella. Now, that's a huge task, but at least it looks possible from this point of view. So you're right. I'd like to do the same thing White did. Like, you try to work that through. You know, it's like it's so complex, all in terms of the different rates of the different occasions and how they prehend. And we can really get into it. Great, it's all a matter of time and attention to work it out in more detail, and then to see how those details help us to develop new scientific procedures. That's what's really interesting. And you can do, and new yogic procedures, which is what I'm really interested in, right? So, like I say, it's a metaphysical system that makes all these things possible. But to actually work out the details is the work of many people over generations. Yeah. You
know, just to think of those things at all in one collection without having worked out anything, seems to me a pretty major achievement.
I think it is, you know. But, you know, again, it's a major achievement, but at this point, it hasn't been worked out in detail. It's like, you know, if you go back to Galileo, Galileo worked out this incredible method. He really got the scientific method pretty well knocked out, right? But, of course, it took 400 years to establish this relevance and validity in a whole variety of fields. So we're sort of at the Galileo stage here of this new way of thinking.
Speaking of all that, are you still going to give a lecture on where we go from here? Or?
No. Well, I can introduce the topic. Let me do that. I'd actually just love to share this. So I've been reading, as I think I've been telling you, the essays on the Gita by Sri Aurobindo. And I'm finding the book just deeply, deeply moving. And one of the things he talks about, there's so many ideas in there I'd like to share with you, but one of them is he talks about how in looking at human beings alive on the planet today, I may have told you some of this before, remind me if I'm saying it again, but he talks about how there are these three basic aims that are alive in human beings. Right? And the first aim is the aim at living a good human life. Right? Just like my father was like that. Like, he just wanted to live a life, and he wanted to do it well. Right? My best friend back east, he was saying, you know, he says, living a life is enough. Right? And so when I try to talk philosophy with him, he just gets confused. He doesn't really understand what the point is. Right? And so this is a valid way of living. It's an important spiritual stage. And as Sri Aurobindo points out, if it weren't for these people, the world would fall apart. We need them, right? And so it's all great, right? But it's just really interesting to notice, in terms of aim, that a lot of people simply don't aim beyond the living of a good life. And so that's why they find us so irrelevant, right? Now, then, there's a stage beyond that at which people begin to discover ideals. Right? And so people discover the ideal of knowledge, the ideal of beauty, the ideal of security, you know, all these different ideals, right? Art, you have art, the ideal of beauty, right? And so then we get another type of person who's not just interested in living a life, but who wants to do something significant, right? Wants to write a book or make a painting or lead a movement or something, right? We get these different kinds of ambitions that come in, and it's sort of a higher level of spiritual development, Sri Aurobindo's claim, right? But what's interesting to me is that, and all of us belong to that category, we would never have gotten to graduate school, right? So we all have these feelings of like, wanting to do something significant and meaningful, right? But they're very confusing, because to begin with, like, we get captured by them. Like, oh, I've got to save the planet from ecological destruction. Or, oh, I've got to create a philosophy for the integral age. Or whatever we come up with, right? And then we sort of live that way. But if we really step back and think about it, why? Why does it really matter?
What's the ultimate point, right? And so you live a life, you live a great life, and you become a great philosopher, and people read your books for 200 years, or you become a great politician, or you, whatever, you become a great housewife and having 10 credible kids who help the world, whatever you do, right? So what? Where's it all going? What's the point of life? Right? It's like Sri Aurobindo says, we have the middle.
Hold on, I just want to make sure I'm ready for this. Go ahead. What's the point of life?
I wasn't going to say. So, like, we have the beginning and we have the end, but we don't know the whole point, right? So at some point, as we begin to grow into this, as we begin to feel the way all of our projects are diverse and sort of ultimately pointless, we begin to look for something beyond all that. We begin to look for something that's permanent, for something that has enduring significance, and for something that can make sense out of the very existence of the world, and that can give the whole world a sense of origin and destination and meaning. Because after all, we're not going to get there by philosophy, we're not going to get there by art, we're not going to get there by tantra, you know? We need something to get us beyond all the relativity and all this bewilderment, right? And so it needs to be a divine factor in existence, right? There has to be something absolute out of which we've arisen and towards which we're progressing. I don't know how else to give life meaning. I don't know how else to see it as anything but samsara, as an endless pursuit of ultimately empty goals, unless the whole thing is pervaded by a divine spirit and is going towards some relationship with the absolute. Without forming some relationship between human being as we live it and some absolute divine factor in existence, there is no satisfying issue from the endless suffering of life. This just seems to be absolutely necessary. Right? And that's why I want to talk about not the ecozoic, but the theozoic era. Because I think it's really all about creating greater human-divine intimacy. And I think in this new theozoic era, technological progress will be equated with greater human-divine intimacy. But that's really what it's all about. And I think that in terms of how we're moving forward, this is a really important part of how we're moving forward. Because when I was talking about these technologies, right, the synchronistic technology, the symbolic technology, the physical technology, right? We all know, better than anybody in history will ever know again, probably, how incredibly destructive technology can be. And that's true especially for industrial technology. But even for transphysical technologies, there can be evil uses for them. And I would suspect that on the planet right now, most of the use that's being made of them are evil at the current time, given the current climate, right? And so if we're going to move ahead technologically into this new era, we can't separate it from a moral development, right? If we don't have a soul awakening on this planet, no matter what we do, we're doomed, right? We've got to wake up to the significance of the divine in our existence. And without that, the movement into the integral era is not possible. The integral is theozoic, right? The transparency, the diaphaneity of the integral mutation is brought about by the intimacy with the unconditioned origin. That's what makes the difference, right? So that is what I wanted to say today about moving forward. So, and we have 2 minutes, if anybody wants to top that.
Well, there's this desire to have human intimacy, but the way you get human intimacy is the closer we become to God, the closer we become to each other.
Exactly.
And God provides the trust and the goodwill and all the things required. And so whenever there becomes like this humanistic or non-theistic aim at peace and harmony, it's inherently flawed.
That's correct.
Because it's this limited perspective And if we can each, see, the problem, I think, is if we're trying to create a collective drive to peace on earth, we miss the individual drive. And as individuals, as we try to find our own intimacy with God, then we will have peace on earth. But if we're constantly focused externally on the group, trying to make the group have peace, and don't have peace in ourselves, then it's just not possible. And
right.
That's, I think, a key flaw in the woo-woo drive to create utopian societies.
Right.
They're all self-centered,
exactly.
But not self-oriented in a certain sense.
I couldn't agree with you more, right?
Yeah.
But it raises a really interesting problem, particularly considering your Christianity, right? Because, and this whole issue that sometimes come up around exclusivity, right? Because I completely agree with you. But I would probably not be comfortable with the way, particular way you would mythologize this, right? So what I want to say is that we have an interesting problem here, because I feel heart-to-heart completely aligned with you, so there's no problem. But the problem is that every time we talk about God, every time we define it, we're making up a new religion that somebody can fight with, right? And so somehow or other, we have to find some way of speaking about that one. Sri Aurobindo calls it the alum. It's a beautiful word for it, the alum, right? We need a way to speak about it that doesn't involve us in sectarian conflict about its definition.
He who must not be named.
He who must not be named.
Why not?
Lady Yahweh, right?
We're going to fight him for that.
Yeah, because, you know, but I just leave that as one of the problems. Thank you so much for class today. And I'll see you next week. And by the way, I took a look ahead. Chapter